There once was a priest in Israel who was called by God to be a prophet in Israel, and his name was Ezekiel. Those are two very different job assignments, by the way. And if there was a human resources department for the people of Israel, this transfer within the system would not have been allowed. The priestly duty of overseeing sacrifices, helping people through passages of life, and providing for those in need are much different than the role of the prophet. The prophet does some foretelling, of course, letting folks know what the future holds, but mostly it's forthtelling, pointing out in no uncertain terms the ethical demands of God. The priest's composure keeps things in place, and people love a good, calm priest. But the prophet's holy rage might break everything in the room and some feelings as well. Ezekiel signed up to be a priest, and then he was called to be a prophet. We are quite familiar with God's calling of leaders in the Bible. God said to Abram, "I will give you land, and your people will be my people." Moses got a burning bush. Deborah received a song. Samuel heard a still, small voice calling his name. In the New Testament, John gets to baptize Jesus. The fishermen get to lay down their nets and follow Jesus. Saul gets a blinding light, a new name, and the once-in-a-lifetime chance to shape the theology of billions of people on earth. Ezekiel, he received a vision, a very scary vision. "I was among the exiles by the river Kabar," he says at the beginning. He and others had been exiled to Babylon. Tenseness of the situation might explain the nearly psychedelic nature of the vision he receives. A stormy wind came from the north, a great cloud with brightness around it, fire flashing forth continually, a gleaming amber in the middle of the cloud. And that's just the beginning. In the middle, four living creatures, human form, faces, four wings each, straight legs, but bronze feet, and the soles of the feet were like a calf's foot. Human hands and one human face, but also the face of a lion, an ox, and an eagle. Each creature has a turning wheel and a wheel within a wheel. Over their heads is a dome shining like a crystal. Wheels are turning, wings are flapping, and he said it sounded like mighty waters, like thunder, like an army, all at the same time. For us, it would be just like walking into a Chuck E. Cheese restaurant after four school buses have unloaded. Sensory overload. But for Ezekiel, it translated into a holy moment, like the bow in a cloud on a rainy day, he said. Such was the appearance of the splendor all around, the likeness of the glory of the Lord, he said. He fell on his face, and he heard the voice of someone speaking. His calling would begin. The voice said, "Get up." A spirit entered, and he did just that. "Mortal, I am sending you to the people of Israel, to a nation of rebels who have rebelled against me. They are a stubborn people, and I am sending you to them. And you will say to them, 'Thus says the Lord God.' And they will know they have heard from a prophet. Don't be afraid of them, and don't be afraid of their response. And don't be upset when you see the looks on their faces. They are a rebellious people." That's his calling. To talk to stubborn people about a message they don't want to hear. In the next chapter, God tells Ezekiel, "They won't listen to me, so I'm sure they're not going to listen to you. They have a hard forehead and a stubborn heart. But whether they hear or refuse to hear makes no difference. You just go along, give them my message about how my holiness is more important than their perceived needs, about how my name should not be used carelessly or for their own benefit or for service to some other ideology or political motive. The whole book is about this calling and how it plays out. And that vision about the four heads and the wheels and the fire, that's just the beginning. At the beginning of chapter 3, Ezekiel is told to eat a scroll. And as one commentator dryly notes, there is no precedent for eating scrolls." We are probably most familiar with the episode later in the book, The Valley of the Dry Bones, where God breathes life, puts flesh on those bones. Them dry, dry bones. There is no doubt this is a strange book. And because of some of his detailed descriptions of Israel's transgressions, in some Jewish communities, you could not read the book until you were at least the age of 30. You can't help but feel a little sorry for Ezekiel. I mean, you've dealt with stubborn people before, right? It's clear in your mind, maybe the whole world's mind, regarding what needs to be done about a particular situation. It's obvious, but they say no. So you strategize. I'll use logic and facts, and they will stop being so stubborn. It's clear. Everyone will benefit if you agree to do this. As a matter of fact, you yourself will benefit. The whole world will be a better place, but it doesn't work. Stubborn. Another strategy, going overboard with praise for the person to the point of insincerity. Butter them up, we like to say, although I've always found that expression rather odd, but you lay it on thick about how that person is the smartest, most respected person on the planet, impeccable style and adored by all, but they still won't budge. So stubborn. Fill in the following blank. So-and-so is as stubborn as a... Are you all so stubborn you won't even say it? So-and-so is so stubborn as a... Of course, mules have quite a reputation, and for the sake of clarity, a mule is the offspring of a male donkey and a female horse. Now, when Kristen Hayday in the United Kingdom studied mules, horses, donkeys, and compared them to domesticated dogs, she found that mules were more intelligent than horses and donkeys. Did you catch that, young people? The child was more intelligent than the parent. And the mule was even on par with the domesticated dog. So your little dog at home, no smarter than a mule. So why do mules have that reputation? Meredith Hodges of Lucky Three Ranch in Colorado says that it is really only an abundance of common sense and a strong desire for self-preservation that makes them inclined to resist whatever you are asking them to do. Stubborn people and stubborn animals are simply looking out for their own self-preservation as they perceive it in the moment. And that's understandable. Ezekiel's job, at least in the early part of the book, wasn't to change their minds. He was simply sent to deliver a message. The decision, the change in behavior, would have to be theirs, and he need not take on that burden for himself. Old Testament theologian Walter Brueggemann finds something really important for ministers and people of faith who work hard to help folks who sometimes work against themselves. The prophet, or the minister, or the helper, is asked to tell the truth as they know it. There is danger in not telling the truth to others and to ourselves. Give the facts, be kind, be compassionate, but set a limit and release yourself from the burden of making a decision that is not yours to make. It's a painful statement, but you can't change a person's heart. You can't change a person's mind. Only God can do that. Only the person can do that. Now, I admit there is some blatant and obvious hypocrisy to everything I have said thus far. When we read texts like this, we automatically place ourselves in the story from the perspective of the person called to do something difficult on God's behalf. But what if we are not the divine prophet sent by God? What if we are the people who are so stubborn, stone-faced, mule-minded, and eager to chase away any emissary of God who attempts to tell us otherwise? Whenever a new word comes to us that challenges the comfort we have so skillfully crafted for ourselves, our reaction is consistent with what seems to frustrate us in others. It takes a lot for us to recognize our own stubbornness. There is a solution to all of this stubbornness, however. Whether we are the ones convincing someone of an obvious truth to us, or resisting an honest and heartfelt message from someone who is experiencing our own stubbornness, it's the answer to a lot of problems in life, and it shows up throughout the words of Jesus and in the context of community in the letters of Paul. It's simple yet complicated. It's love. We only have one word for it in our language, but the Greek language and culture, as you have heard many times, the language in which the New Testament was written, has more than one word for love. It's not romantic love we're talking about, and it's not just love between friends. It's agape, the love that God has for us and the love that we are called to have for one another. It's the cure for stubbornness, because it's not in a hurry. It's willing to wait and walk beside someone as they make hard decisions. It's not transactional. I'm not looking for anything in return. If I have agape love for you, you can't do anything that will make me not love you. My love for you is not dependent on your love for me. That's why it's so challenging, yet so necessary, so universal and critical to the human experience. And it's best found in community, because we need each other to develop that kind of love. You heard a wonderful report from Kathy Summers last week on Vacation Bible School, where for four nights we immersed ourselves in the parable of the sower and the seeds. By the way, could you imagine if Ezekiel had attended Bible school? Dear parent, please help us. Your son decided to eat a chapter of the Bible tonight, and when we asked the children to draw a nice picture, he drew monsters and skeletons and made everyone, including the teachers, cry. Well, I was in charge of the Bible study rotation, and I invited two of our congregation's experts in growing things to meet with the children. Dale Peterson, the hydrangea whisperer, brought some beautiful blooms, as well as an impressive assortment of weeds, surely not from his yard, to help illustrate that part of the parable. Frank Randall grows food for humans and animals, so he brought some seeds and his wealth of knowledge and experience. I worked with the children to prepare some questions in advance, and boy, did they have plenty of questions. One child wanted to know how to grow a flower, but specifically how to grow a pink or a red flower. Others were interested in how to control the animals who might eat what they are growing. Bunnies, especially, were on the children's minds. One elementary age philosopher in the group wanted to know how our experts developed patience. Specifically, how do you learn to wait for things to grow? She asked. At the session with the youngest group, I think there were at least four hands in the air at one time, some to ask questions and some just to share their own stories of growing vegetables and trees with parents and grandparents. And as I watched Dale and Frank field these questions and the absolute attention the kids gave these wise and caring individuals, the community that was developing and taking place, the formation of agape love that occurs in sustained interactions over time, I was reminded that love for each other and for a shared commitment and mission to develop the best in one another. That's what we are here for, not just here, but on earth, locally and universally. I was only partially joking about Ezekiel being at Vacation Bible School. Who knows? The next Ezekiel might have been there, might be among us, might be receiving a call of God to speak truth to everyone, including us. And maybe we will have the courage to hear that message, whatever it might be, and maybe love will transform our stubbornness into action. Amen.